Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Today on Inside Politics, the people of the state of New York versus Donald J. Trump. Right now, the former president is sitting in a court as a criminal defendant, keeping an eye on the prospective jurors who could make him a convicted felon. CNN is inside and outside the courtroom with all of the breaking details on this critical moment in American history. And the Biden campaign says that while Trump is in court, Biden is, quote, running the country. Today, he heads to his hometown of Scranton, Pennsylvania, to channel his working class roots and talk about taxes in the middle class. Plus, quote, I am not resigning. That's a quote from Mike Johnson. It was his message to his caucus as another House Republican joins the push to kick him out as Speaker. This now means that if he wants to keep his gavel, he'll likely need Democrats to help. I'm Dana Bash. Let's go behind the headlines and inside politics. We start with breaking news from downtown Manhattan. It is day two of the first ever criminal trial of a former president. Jury selection in the Trump hush money trial is moving at a glacial pace. Dozens of potential jurors have already been dismissed for saying they can't be impartial, they can't be fair. Others were excused because of personal scheduling conflicts. So far, exactly zero jurors have actually been chosen. This could take a while. Right now, lawyers on both sides are questioning the 18 people who made it through the written questionnaire phase of the jury selection. They're talking about where they work, where they're from, where they live, what they read, whether they went to college, even what they do for fun. As for Trump, he is inside the courtroom. Reporters in the room tell us that at times he's been looking at individual jurors directly. At other times, he appears to be closing his eyes as answers are being read. CNN's Laura Coates is outside the courtroom in Manhattan with our colleagues Kara Scannell and Kristen Holmes. Laura.
Thank you so much, Dana. It is an historic day. We're in day two now of the jury selection process. And of course, now it's really in the thick of it. You've got jurors who are in what's called the box of the courtroom. They're now being questioned by the lawyers. This written questionnaire we've all become accustomed to now is now obsolete, right? They're asking questions now to delve deeper, Kara, into how these jurors might ultimately be able to be impartial.
Yeah, and the first one up is now the prosecution. One of the prosecutors on the case is now addressing the jury box and asking them questions. He has 30 minutes to ask these questions and try to root out any possible concerns that he might be able to identify in any of these jurors.
Not per juror, per total.
Is that right?
This is 30 minutes to talk to the 18 jurors that are currently in the box. And he's talking to them about who they might hear from in this case. He said that there are some witnesses who have some edge, the former publisher of the National Enquirer, an adult film star, and Michael Cohen, who has already admitted to having lied. And he's asking the jurors, can you set aside likability and credibility? Can you, you know, if you don't like the person, can you still find them credible? Our colleagues say that no juror in the box said that they couldn't. And he was trying to say, you know, you shouldn't decide it just on what this one person says. Anyway, can you keep an open mind until you hear all of the evidence that comes into this case? Don't just hang it on one person. The jurors have said that they could. You know, there was also questions he asked out of the gate. How do you feel about being a juror? And one person responded that he believed he could judge it on the merits of the case. Another said, I don't think my politics matter here. I'll listen to the evidence. So they're asking these questions to try to get a sense of what the people's mindset is as they're thinking about taking on this responsibility.
You know, on that responsibility, Kristen, we spoke with a juror who had been dismissed just a few moments ago, and she described this dichotomy between the weight of the moment and then serving. Listen to what she had to say. This was Kara McGee, who was just recently dismissed.
It's someone who you've seen as this larger than life public figure for a decade or so at this point. You know that this is history in the making, and whatever the outcome of this is, everything going forward will be affected by it. And at the same time, you walk into the courtroom and you see Trump sitting there. I had never seen him in person before. You see him sitting there and it's like, oh, it's just a guy.
But Kristen, this is a guy who happens to be Donald Trump in Manhattan, and prosecutors are almost done questioning in their initial 30-minute window. Imagine that dynamic for many of these jurors for the first time.
I mean, imagine it's both frightening, intimidating, but also kind of, you know, stunning to walk into this. You're walking into jury duty. You're sitting here being like, am I going to be chosen for this case? And then all of a sudden it's Donald Trump. And I'm sure some people had to actually do a double take because he's sitting in a courtroom, probably looks almost like anybody else. Not the first thing you do is look at the person sitting there as the defendant. The other part of this is that Donald Trump is not just a normal famous person. He is an incredibly polarizing figure. And we saw this yesterday when people walked into the room and started giggling immediately or burst out or gasped. And those people obviously ended up being dismissed. But it was interesting to just to see the reaction and the gravity that people are feeling walking into this room. But it's also part of the reason why both the prosecution and the defense are concerned that it's going to be hard to find people who are impartial. Because when you walk in and you see this incredibly polarizing figure, you also note how this could, as she said, change everything. And we are still ahead of that November election, and this could very well play a role in that election.
And remember, one of the questions on the questionnaire was about the candidacy and the impact of that. But again, these important opinions they have, now you worry about confirmation bias, Dana, to figure out whether or not the person's opinion can be confirmed or doubled down throughout the course of the testimony. And that works against both the prosecution and the defense.
Somebody who's actually done this as a prosecutor. Thanks so much to you and to our colleagues, Kara and Kristen. Appreciate it, Laura. Let's bring in two other legal experts, CNN's senior legal analyst and former federal prosecutor Ellie Honig and the director of the Harvard Criminal Justice Institute, Professor Ronald Sullivan. Professor, I'm going to start with you because I just want to get your take on the whole Donald Trump of it all. And not necessarily about the fact that he's famous, but about the fact that he is somebody who elicits very strong feelings by most Americans, whether you're very strongly for him or very strongly against him. Given the fact that what is going on right now is one of the key questions that is being asked is whether or not you think you can, as a juror, be fair and impartial, how difficult is it to genuinely find a juror who can say yes?
I think it is very difficult and genuinely difficult to find a juror who genuinely can put aside predispositions and those sorts of things in order to render a fair and impartial verdict. But very difficult does not mean impossible. And the court is going to take its time. I know initially you said it's going at a glacial pace, and it is, and it should be. This should take a long time because you actually want to weed out people who are not able to set aside predispositions and biases. And that sort of thing takes time. I've tried a case where it took us a month to choose a jury. We finally got one, but it sometimes these things take a while, and that's not necessarily a bad thing.
Yeah, but I'm suspecting, as I bring in Ellie Honig here, that the professor, when he brought, it took a month to choose a jury, it wasn't a presidential candidate, former president, in the middle of a campaign. And that's obviously the one of the major tricks here. Who benefits most from all of the jurors dropping out in, like, just before they even pass go?
Yeah, so that was a remarkable moment yesterday. The judge started off with a pool of 96 jurors. And when the judge said, how many of you are so biased that you feel like you couldn't possibly sit on this case? He lost over half of that pool, over 50 of them immediately. And I can see both sides of this. On the one hand, if you're sitting there, let's say you're Donald Trump or Donald Trump's lawyers, you're thinking, boy, that's a pretty stark reminder of just how stacked this deck is against us. Because you have to think that all or nearly all of those people were biased against Trump. It's hard to envision someone who said, I just love this guy so much, I can't be on this jury.
That actually did happen, though, today.
Right, but very, very limited. especially somebody who self-identifies and says, let me out of here.
Right.
There may be people who come up in the questioning. On the other hand, if you're Trump, it's probably a good sign that people are being honest, that people aren't kidding themselves about their ability to be impartial. And as a practical matter, you just got rid of of the 50 or so, 48, 49 of them are probably jurors you didn't want anyway. So I agree with the professor. I think the system will not get you a perfect jury. There's no such thing as a perfect jury. It will take time, but I do think it will yield a fair jury.
Professor, let's not just talk in generalities. We have the benefit of having a terrific team there in New York, and they're getting information about potential jurors so that our viewers can get a sense of the kind of people who are in the potential pool. One potential juror has read several books by Donald Trump and also is a member of the ACLU. You can see the media that this juror reads. Let's go to another one, originally from Mexico. Relatively new U.S. citizen, works in marketing, also has hobbies, travel, scuba diving. Looks like they have the New York Times, Huffington Post, MSNBC. What does that tell you, that kind of information, not just about their hobbies, but maybe in this particular case, unfortunately for where we are in the world, where they consume their media?
Well, that sort of information serves as a proxy such that the lawyer can try to determine whether or not that juror is going to be beneficial to his or her side of the case. It's imperfect. It's more art than science, or at least equally art and science. But let's take the one. You have someone from, I think you said, Mexico and in the ACLU. Mm-hmm. Those may not have been the two together, but let's use that as a hypothetical. So you might think that someone from Mexico would be antagonistic to former President Trump because of his comments about the border and so forth. Someone from the ACLU might also be antagonistic to President Trump. But someone from the ACLU might have a deep and abiding appreciation for the rule of law and for the presumption of innocence and so forth. And that might be, in fact, a good juror. So it's you're taking an educated guess as to who, what kind of juror that may be. It's not perfect, but you have limited time and limited information. And lawyers do the best that they can in order to determine who's going to be best for their side of the case.
And Ellie, as I bring you in, I want you to bounce off of what the professor said. We're looking at a live picture outside the courthouse. They just took a break from jury selection, so it's possible that we'll see the former president come out.
Let me guess what he'll say if he comes out. Right, he sort of has his usual script. You know, the professor's right that when you look at these forms and when you hear the answers from the jurors, a lot of times it's a mixed bag, right? Some of the examples there, as the professor noted, you can oftentimes interpret things either way. And what you do as a lawyer is you are watching those jurors, those potential jurors, every move they make. You're looking at how are they dressed. You're looking at superficial things. You're looking at how is the person groomed? Does the person have a long ponytail? Like that, there are things that you can learn or at least guess based on looking at people. If they're holding any reading material, a lot of times people, they can't bring their phones sometimes, so they're holding a book. What book are they reading, right? I thought it was interesting. The first example was somebody who had read some of Trump's books. Now, that could go either way, right? Because, I mean, the art of the deal, maybe you read it because you think it's this font of wisdom. Maybe you read it because you want to understand where this guy came from. You don't like him, and you want to understand his origins. So there's a lot of interpretation involved here.
Really, really interesting. I think we're going to be talking about this for several days, but it is fascinating to see how, listen, this is part of our system and to see how it works. And it is very important, as both of you have pointed out. Ellie, thank you. Professor Ronald Sullivan, thank you. Don't go away, because while Donald Trump is in a Manhattan courtroom, President Biden is heading to the battleground state of Pennsylvania. The campaign split screen we are about to see much, much more of next.
This podcast is supported by Sleep Number. Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs, so you can choose what's right for each of you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores? Sleep Number does that. Only Sleep Number Smart Beds let you each choose your ideal comfort and support, your Sleep Number setting. Sleep Number Smart Beds learn how you sleep and provide personalized insights to help you sleep better. All Sleep Number smart beds feature cooling, pressure-relieving comfort layers for soothing sleep throughout the night. Temperature-balancing bedding is designed to move heat and moisture away when you're hot. When you're cool, they hold their energy to help warm you. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
I'm Dr. Sanjay Gupta, CNN's chief medical correspondent. This week on Chasing Life...
I'm a health reporter and have been for 15 years. And even I feel overwhelmed by some of the things I read about the stuff we're eating.
My colleague Meg Terrell wanted to take a deep dive into something you've probably heard a lot about recently. Ultra-processed foods. There is a lot to learn there, some fascinating stuff. And some of it is probably going to change the way you shop. Listen to Chasing Life, wherever you get your podcasts.
When Donald Trump entered the New York City courthouse this morning, he didn't just attack the judge overseeing his hush money case. He also lamented having to be in court at all.
I should be right now in Pennsylvania, in Florida, in many other states, North Carolina, Georgia, campaigning. This is all coming from the Biden White House because the guy can't put two sentences together. He can't campaign. They're using this in order to try and win an election. And it's not working that way. It's working the opposite way.
Before we get to our panel, I want to note that Trump's claim about Biden orchestrating the trial is baseless. The case was brought by a New York district attorney. There's no evidence that Joe Biden was involved at all. Now, I am joined by our great panel today, CNN's Jeff Zeleny, Bloomberg, and CNN's Nia Malika Henderson and Hans Nichols of Axios. Hello, everybody. Good to see you. Jeff Zeleny, let me start with you. You are out talking to voters all the time in all the states that he just named and more. How much do you think what is happening and what will continue to happen will resonate where it matters most politically?
We'll have to see what the outcome of the trial is. We'll have to see what how this affects the former president personally. This is not just a random trial about numbers. It's about something very personal to him. So we will just have to, it's hard to do, but be patient and watch the political fallout of this. But I did think it was interesting mentioning Florida and North Carolina. Florida is not really a battleground state. Perhaps he was thinking about being home at Mar-a-Lago where the season, is almost ending. So he is going to miss the end of the season at Mar-a-Lago. But North Carolina, he's actually going on Saturday. And that is a state that the Biden campaign is trying to make competitive. It's the bluest red. If you will, it was the smallest margin of victory for Trump. But look, at the end of the day, he does not hold many campaign rallies on a Tuesday or during the week. So in the short term, I'm not sure it has any effect. In fact, he's on television more now because of what he's doing around Manhattan.
I think missing the end of the Palm Beach season is when he maybe could have tried with the judge, see how that worked.
Right. Yeah. Well, listen, I mean, when Donald Trump, could campaign during the primary, he didn't really campaign, right? I think in some ways he's sort of over campaigning and he might be just as happy to sit around, maybe not in a courtroom, but certainly sit around Mar-a-Lago. But he obviously wants to make that an issue. North Carolina, an interesting state. They've got a really, I think, MAGA governor who's running. I think the Biden team definitely sees that as someplace they can make Republicans spend money, even if they can't necessarily make it competitive in the general. I will say about this, we don't really know what's going to come out of this trial, right? We obviously don't know what the verdict will be, but also just the salacious details, some of which we already know, but it's likely that this trial is going to uncover other uncomfortable allegations and facts around Donald Trump.
Look, we have a national campaign with Donald Trump. I mean, he's there talking, they're doing jury selection, but he's talking to the rest of the jury in the states that he is mentioning. And that's so clearly his play here, is that he wants to make this a national event. This allows him in some ways to be all those states when he's actually in Manhattan. And the sort of curious dynamic about the campaign is that it's going to be contested in six, maybe seven states, right? The Biden administration and the White House really wants to put North Carolina in play. But Donald Trump is trying to make it national. Mm-hmm. And that strikes me as that he can in some ways be in more places than one by being in court and broadcast his message out. Now, look, I'm sure he hated the audio, right? I mean, when we all listen to that.
And the visual wasn't great either.
Donald Trump is a very good television producer. yeah. He probably hated that audio. And forgive me for whoever the technician was that did it. Maybe they're trying their best. But Donald Trump likes images. He likes sound. And yes, he gets to broadcast the rest of the country there.
Perhaps
the audio
one side know that he can't control everything.
Yeah, well, yeah, exactly. All right. So the former president, while he was he said, well, Joe Biden's not campaigning. He actually is. He's in Pennsylvania today. The topic, according to the campaign, taxes, what to do about the Trump tax cuts that will expire next year, which in a normal election would be a really, really big issue. CNN's Arlette Sines is in Scranton. Arlette, it is a big issue. The question is, how much campaign sees on this topic?
Yeah, Dana. Well, President Biden today is really trying to draw a sharp economic contrast with former President Donald Trump as he kicks off this three-day swing through Pennsylvania. But he's also drawing a contrast when it comes to how they're spending their time, as the president will be here in the state on the campaign trail while Trump is in a New York City courtroom facing criminal trial. But the president's focus for his speech today will really be on tax policy, trying to make this argument that the former president is developing a policy that benefits billionaires and the wealthy and not the middle class. We've really seen the Biden campaign recently seizing on the fact that Trump recently told donors that one of his top priorities, if he's elected to a second term, would be extending those sweeping 2017 tax cuts that he signed into law. Those tax cuts impacted all Americans, but really benefited the wealthy far more. President Biden, for his part, has been campaigning on raising taxes on the wealthy and corporations while promising not to raise taxes for those families making $400,000 or less. But the president is returning here to Scranton, Pennsylvania, his hometown. This is a place that he often comes to try to make that connection with working class voters. I traveled here many times with him back in 2020, and his argument back in that campaign was that it was a choice between Scranton versus Park Avenue. Heading into this visit, his campaign team has really framed this election as one being between the kitchen tables facing Scranton voters and the, quote, country club Mar-a-Lago vision of former President Donald Trump. Now, to back up some of their arguments that the president is working for the working class, they released a new digital video today with some personal testimonials from President Biden's family members and close friends from when he grew up here in Scranton. Take a listen.
Scranton is a set of values. We pride ourselves on the importance of family and honesty and hard work.
Scranton really, I think, is the case study for what President Biden has done since he's taken office. 4 years ago, we were distressed. We're out of financial distress as a city. For the first time in a long time, we have a president who understands normal middle-class people like me.
Now, this also all comes as Biden is trying to move the needle with voters who have pessimistic views of his handling of the economy. But Pennsylvania certainly will be one of those critical states to Biden as he's seeking re-election, as polling here recently has really shown a very close race between the two candidates.
Arlette, thank you. And over your shoulder, we see tax fairness for all Americans. That clearly is sort of the bumper sticker takeaway that the Biden campaign wants everybody to have with this event today. Thanks, Arlette. And on that note, I was talking to somebody at in Biden world this morning saying, okay, the president potentially, you could argue, like almost stopped World War III over the weekend. We know that there is a very big desire by a lot of swing voters to hear more about reproductive rights. Mm-hmm. The economy is a tough one for him. Why this? And the answer is what you saw in that sign. They actually believe that of all the economic sort of troubles that people are feeling, the we're going to make taxes more fair for you is a potent one that's actually moving the needle a bit.
And it allows them to throw the conversation forward, right? Mm-hmm. Everything Joe Biden is doing is trying to turn this election into a choice and not a referendum. Now, over his shoulder, it's tax fairness. I didn't see Bidenomics over his shoulder, right?
Right, yeah.
And that's great a little point. Unfair. Maybe he'll say it, right? Maybe he'll come out and make a big, full-throated defense of Bidenomics, mm-hmm. and he'll mention that. But anytime they can make this more about a choice, you saw the president in his sort of knee-jerk response to the inflation numbers, and then the White House later really leaned into it, that you think inflation's bad now, wait until Donald Trump is president. Mm-hmm. Now, that's a fine argument, they can make it, but that's a different argument than the argument before, which was, we understand how, like, you know, how much you're hurting, here are the things the president is doing. They're trying to just make this into a contrast, and we're gonna have that for the next 6 months.
And, you know, he's trying to sound like a populist, right? This idea that Donald Trump only cares about his rich friends who are down in Mar-a-Lago, who are donating millions of dollars to his campaign. And Joe Biden, the kid from Scranton, he cares about just average Joes and Janes out in the Midwest. And so we'll see if it works. I mean, their problem is that if you look at polls, the advantage that Trump has on the economy, it's like 20
points. Let me just quickly bring that up. Just one example, the Wall Street Journal. This is about Pennsylvania, where the president is today. Trump 52, Biden 35%.
Right.
On the economy.
So for all of the noise in this election about a criminal trial there, other issues, a certain foreign policy is very important, but it is the economy that this election could hinge on. And I think what Hans said about this being forward-looking, the president has been kind of, there have been some inner conversations with his team about how much he wants to talk about his accomplishments versus, you know what, people want to know what you are going to do. So that's what all of this is about.
But by inner conversations, Jeff means raging debates that we're trying to get readouts on. But you're right.
I mean, but that's the thing. So look, that's what he's trying to do here. But also significant, he's back on the campaign trail.
Right.
Donald Trump is not.
Yeah. That's very true. Everybody stand by. Up next, potential jurors are packed into a Manhattan courtroom as the court is trying to find the 12 men and women who will hear the case against Donald Trump. We're live outside that courthouse next. Back to our top story, Donald Trump in a Manhattan courtroom. Right now, as jury selection continues in his hush money criminal trial, the former president's legal team is now questioning potential jurors about their opinions of Trump. Attorney Todd Blanch said, quote, "You're not going to offend me or the court or even President Trump." CNN's Laura Coates and Kara Scannell are still outside that courthouse. Kara and Laura, what else are you hearing?
There are so many big moments that are happening right now inside of the courtroom behind us. And it's so consequential, Kara, because to have these jurors be questioned by the defense counsel, by the prosecution, this is after that original questionnaire. This is a very, very tedious process, a very lengthy one. One juror was asked this question about what her opinion of Donald Trump, in fact, was. Here's how she responded. "I don't really have one, especially in this courtroom. I think he will be treated as anybody else, and no one is above the law. So I am here to hear the facts on both sides." And remember, this is a potential juror. She may be in that room right now among the 18, but that doesn't mean that she'll actually sit.
Right. They are doing, each side has 30 minutes right now. The prosecution finished their 30. Trump's lawyer, Todd Blanch, is up doing his 30 minutes. You know, underscoring to the jurors here, he said, this is extraordinary serious. This is very serious to President Trump in the courtroom. And so he is saying to them, as you said, he wants to know what their opinion is. And so one juror, a male juror, said, you know, if we were in a bar, I would tell you my opinion. But in this courtroom, I don't really have a strong enough one to get into it with you. So they're trying to figure out what people's view here is of Trump, because, you know, they ultimately want to know if they like him or not and if they can put it aside and what they'll say on that. I mean, the one juror who's in there who is a prosecutor said he understands that the prosecution's job is to have to prove their case beyond a reasonable doubt. He also said that he has several friends in law enforcement who are pro-Trump. So we're learning a little bit more about who these jurors are and the world that they live in.
I mean, this is a kind of speed dating, is it not, when you think about it, Dana, and trying to figure out how all this is going to go down. And of course, these jurors may or may not ultimately be the ones to sit here. If you have questions out there about the trial, you can just go to CNN.com/Trump trial questions and you can type in your question there, and we will air it on Laura Coates Live tonight at 11 p.m. Dana, really important.
That's very cool that you're doing that. Very cool. Definitely be sure to tune in tonight to Laura's show at 11 p.m. Eastern. Coming up, the effort to oust House Speaker Mike Johnson is now growing, with another hardline Republican supporting Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene's effort to take Johnson's gavel away. We'll give you the latest information on the fast-breaking news there after a quick break.
I'm Ina Garten. Welcome to Be My Guest, the podcast. One of the best gifts you can give friends is spending time together. But what's even better than that? Cooking with them. On Be My Guest, the podcast, new friends and old stop by my barn for some conversation and great cooking. We talk about food, life, and everything in between. Listen to Be My Guest, the podcast with me, Ina Garten, and join us wherever you get your podcasts.
House Speaker Mike Johnson is fighting to keep his job, the job he's had for less than 6 months. At least two House Republicans are threatening to oust him over his plans to handle Ukraine aid, aid to Israel. This was his message just a short while ago.
I am not resigning, and it is, in my view, an absurd notion that someone would bring a vacate motion when we are simply here trying to do our jobs. It is not helpful to the cause. It is not helpful to the country. It does not help the House Republicans advance our agenda, which is in the best interest of the American people here.
CNN's Manu Raju is on Capitol Hill. You've been talking to lawmakers all morning. Obviously, Manu, this is about, in the short term, the politics for Mike Johnson. But we shouldn't lose sight, of course, of the fact that Ukraine and Ukraine's allies, both here and abroad, have been begging Mike Johnson to do something quickly so that they don't lose to Russia.
Yeah, this has been going on for months and months and months. And just about 2 months ago is when the Senate passed its own foreign aid package that Mike Johnson sidelined as he tried to come up with his own strategies. He tried to win over Republicans. And just yesterday, he announced that strategy, saying that he's going to move forward on separate bills for Ukraine, for Israel, for Taiwan, and another bill that includes other policy measures, including a ban, something that could eventually lead to a ban on TikTok. But here's the catch. It is expected that the House will use a parliamentary maneuver to essentially put all those bills in together in one package and send that over to the Senate. And that is what's causing a lot of angst within the GOP ranks. A lot of Republicans, particularly on the hard right, have said there should not be another dime for Ukraine. They do not want to tie this to aid to Israel. Democrats, the White House, want it all tied together because of what they say is an essential, essentially an emergency for Ukraine. They say that this money is needed right now. Now, this all comes, of course, as the threat to push out Mike Johnson is growing. In fact, Thomas Massie, who is a Kentucky Republican, announced behind closed doors that he would support this effort by Marjorie Taylor Greene to push out Mike Johnson from the speakership. And he called on Johnson directly to resign. And I asked him about that interaction in that tense exchange behind closed doors.
So you want him to resign? You want him to resign?
Yes. Yeah, I asked him to resign.
What did he say?
He said he would not. And then I said, well, you're the one who's going to put us into this. Because the motion is going to get called.
I'm not a big fan of this, you know. Well, I like the individual votes. I'm not a big fan of putting them all back together.
What about the motion to vacate?
We don't need that. No way. No way. We don't want that. We shouldn't go through that again.
So you're seeing a difference of an opinion there from two conservatives on the right flank of the Republican conference. Of course, Jim Jordan's being one who's influential within a lot of Republicans. But it's interesting to hear Jordan there. While he opposes this effort to push out Mike Johnson, he also is opposed to what the speaker is trying to do here. You're seeing a lot of divisions among Republicans at this critical time because there's a question here, Dana. How long can Johnson survive? And does Mike Johnson even have the votes to get this measure out of the House by the end of the week, which is his goal? So just so many things that are riding on these key decisions at this moment, but a very precarious time for the speaker.
Almost Speaker Jim Jordan there saying, no, we should not do this again. The dynamic among Democrats, particularly those who are the most vulnerable, there are several of them who are stepping up saying, you know what, they would potentially vote to help Mike Johnson because it would help them in their swing districts. What's the dynamic there?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, it is an interesting dynamic, much different than what we saw with Kevin McCarthy when all Democrats voted with eight Republicans to oust Kevin McCarthy. This time is different. Several of them, including Tom Suozzi of New York, has told me that he will not vote to oust Mike Johnson. Jared Moskowitz said he would not support Marjorie Taylor Greene's efforts to oust him because he disagrees with Marjorie Taylor Greene on pretty much everything. Whether another member would come forward and push out Mike Johnson, then he said he would evaluate it on that regard. And then there are others who say that if he does move forward on aid to Ukraine, that will be enough for them to save Mike Johnson's speakership. Abigail Spanberger being one of them. So a different dynamic here, Dana. But how will the numbers add up? Will there be enough Democrats to save him? What will the Democratic leaders do on that key vote? Those are all key questions that are coming in the days ahead.
Dana. Okay, I'm glad you got those comfortable shoes on every single day, Manu. Thank you so much for that great reporting. Panel is back here. Your publication has a very simple headline. I'll put it up.
And I didn't write it.
You didn't write it, but it's still simple and very apt. we are screwed.
Well, actually, I did write that one. Look, this is going to be incredibly complicated. I think Manu just did a great job breaking it down. And we're really just, this is basic math at this point on whether or not he's going to survive. For every Republican that, mm-hmm. Johnson loses, he's got to find a Democrat that's willing to come on the side. And that's why, the shoe leather or hopefully comfortable shoes that Manu is wearing are going to be so important, because we're just going to be running around trying to figure this out.
And can we just please take a step back and say, this is not like the most egregious political move that Mike Johnson could make in the grand scheme of things. What he's trying to do is provide money for a democracy in Europe under threat, quite literally under siege. And this is what he is getting.
It's called governing. It's called legislating. It's called carrying out the functions of your office, which to some in his conference is not a positive. But I think one difference here is from the McCarthy thing is just the time and the season we're in. We are during a presidential campaign mm-hmm. season. There's very little tolerance or less tolerance to sort of motion to vacate and throw the speaker out again. I'm not saying it's not going to happen, but when the former president had Speaker Johnson at his side just a few days ago, that was the indication of, mm-hmm. guys, leave him alone, let him do his work. We'll see if they follow through.
Closer to the presidential election, closer to the day that every House member is on the ballot.
Yeah, no, I think that'll make some difference. I mean, it is remarkable that the reason that these Republicans are so up in arms about Ukraine funding is because of President Trump and his approach to Putin, his approach and feelings about Russia. So, here we are seeing them do his bidding again, treating him like he's a president in exile in so many ways. And Mike Johnson in a place that I thought, 6 months ago, it was imagined that he would be here with his speakership on the line, and likely it'll happen again and again.
Okay, up next, the Supreme Court case that could mean many January 6th defendants could go free. And it also may make it harder to prosecute Donald Trump. We'll explain after a quick break. The Supreme Court just heard arguments in a case that could undermine the charges against hundreds of January 6th rioters, and even potentially Donald Trump. Now, Trump isn't involved in this case, but it could have implications for him. CNN's senior Supreme Court analyst Joan Biskupic sat in on today's arguments. She is also the author of 9 Black Robes Inside the Supreme Court's Drive to the Right and Its Historic Consequences, which I should say is out in paperback today. Thank you so much for being here. Sure. You just came from the Supreme
yes.
Court down the street.
Yes.
Can you help our viewers understand why this is even a thing, why this case even made it at all, certainly up to the Supreme Court?
Yes. More than 300 of the January 6th defendants were charged under this provision. It's a 2002 law that was passed in the wake of the Enron accounting scandal. Mm-hmm. And what it does is it punishes anyone who corruptly destroys evidence or, and here's the key part that they grappled with today, otherwise obstructs, influences, or impedes any official proceeding. So the question is, does anyone who's charged under this provision have to have done something to taint, wreck, spoil, destroy evidence at an official proceeding? The federal government says, no, this is sort of this after the word otherwise mm-hmm. is a bit of a catch-all phrase. And this can cover anyone that was involved in January 6th who knew that an official proceeding was going on and tried to disrupt it. Now, Dana, I have to say, the questions from most of the justices from the conservative bloc that dominates suggest that they think the government has gone too far mm-hmm. in its reading of this statute and that it would end up applying, as Samuel Alito said in a hypothetical, maybe to disruptions in the Supreme Court, or maybe to peaceful protests outside.
So does the upshot, if you're reading, which yeah. you've done this many times, I certainly trust your reading of these justices, if it's correct and they're skeptical and they side with the defendants here, yeah. could they be let out of jail? And what would that mean for Donald Trump and the indictment of him?
No, most of these people, including Donald Trump, are charged under multiple offenses.
Okay.
So it could mean less jail time for some people if the court rules against the government here. Or, for example, in the case of Donald Trump, Special Counsel Jack Smith has said, even if you buy the argument here from the January 6th defendant and say that some sort of evidence connection with some records or documents has to be included here, they could go back and recharge him because they say that he proposed fraudulent electoral count documents, and that would meet the definition.
We're out of time, but quickly, Clarence Thomas, he wasn't there yesterday. He was there today. No sign he's going to recuse himself
because of his wife's alleged involvement. Ginny was at January 6th at the rally, but she did not go to the Capitol, and he has not recused himself and not said anything about why, Dana. Okay.
Joan, thank you. I feel so much smarter now, always, when I talk to you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. And thank you for joining Inside Politics. CNN News Central starts after the break.
When you work next level. And when you play next level. And when it's time to sleep, Sleep Number smart beds are designed to embrace your uniqueness, providing you with high-quality sleep every night. Sleep next level. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, the Queen Sleep Number C4 smart bed is only $1,599. Save $300 for a limited time, only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com. Prices higher in Alaska and Hawaii. Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number smart bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.